Well, I would like to start thanking Christina and Thomas for putting this panel together, and also Janina, Sandra, and Michaela for the space of collective envisioning we have come to inhabit in preparation for this. I would like to read, because being in this surgical operation theater, one never knows whether one is the one undertaking the surgical operation or the one or the object of that operation. As much as I believe in the power of stories with a conceptual or a political twist, I wonder what anthropologists might be able to do in the face of issues exceeding the research objects, methods, and forms of output with which our discipline has been existing for decades. In the face of planetary catastrophes, dying infrastructures, or a pike of racism and nationalist divides, how to envision anthropological futures? Many are indeed tentatively devising forms of public engagement in the uncertain hope for a more just present. In the last decade, I've been pondering on this in my work together with activists and professional designers. Design, broadly understood, has been vindicated by a wide variety of anthropologists, not just as a new field of inquiry, a potential field of study for the criticism of the modern project interested in the techno-scientific redefinition of cultures as emergent forms of life, as Michael Fisher would call them. Design has also become, to many of these authors, a source of methodological inspiration, an experimental ground for the interventive renewal of anthropological practice and output. Interestingly, this search for inspiration happens at a time of intense problematizations within the field of design, searching to decolonize their practices, vindicating and making space for making traditions in the global south, or to make them explicitly critical or adversarial. In doing so, practitioners have in turn felt increasingly captivated, paradoxically, by conceptual repertoires from the social sciences, the more recent being a deep engagement with the feminist ethics of care, mobilized to signal a mixture of participatory methods and responses to a quasi-existentialist disconformity with the brutal impact design has had on neoliberalized social relations or the environmental catastrophe. Care standing here as a desire to do something, mobilizing knowledges and skills beyond those of professionals, sometimes wrapped up in a very problematic solutionist agenda. Despite its problems, the notion of care in the work of Maria Puig de la Villacasa or Isabel Estenger also has some speculative nuances. Care as an activation of the possible, that is, what is not there yet or the unfinished that could be, much in the same vein as what Janina referred today as the otherwise. In the advent of many reflections on the need to transform design practice, some of the aforementioned colleagues advocate for anthropology to more decidedly take part in the speculative materialization of alternative forms of world-making to the capitalist and colonial modes of production that have led to the present crisis. But design, as an altering and transformative practice, could also inspire an interesting speculative renewal of the more than textual and interventive prospects of anthropological work in that direction. In the last years, I have been working in close vicinity of urban accessibility activists and their practices of politicizing design. I have alternated fieldwork with public administrators with long hours going through institutional archival material, also taking part intensely in some activist initiatives, mostly in Barcelona, having urban accessibility and open, collaborative, and inclusive design at their very core. Working in the vicinity of those variegated practices, I have learned a lot from their hyperbolic aspirations, fraught methods, and careful experimental practices to open up inclusion and the building of cities more hospitable to bodily diversity, not as a solutionist agenda, but as a problem space. But rather than merely practicing an anthropology of these forms of design and its predicaments, or working and inquiring through its practices, I have, in some cases, felt drawn to practice anthropology as a form of design. What do I mean by this? Allow me to tell you a little story. In November 2015, I joined a delegation from the Bayerische Blinden- und Sehbehindertenbund, revising a new arrangement in Munich. At the time, they were undertaking a relevant pedagogic project. In it, the BBSB Experten in eigene Sache trained students in the BA in landscape architecture to assist them in accessibility advocacy using a marvelous wealth of devices facilitating blind, non-blind architectural design. The BBSB advocates regularly perform accessibility tests in public spaces across Bavaria, writing thorough reports afterwards. This is why they possess a subtle knowledge of legal technicalities and are fluent in this scientific lingo. That day, half a dozen expertinnen eigene with variegated degrees of full or partial blindness explored different elements of the square together with their assistants, measuring in more or less standard fashion the tactile, visual, and light contrast tests across, testing the square's placements. Doing this in the presence of the professional landscape architects who had designed the square, they wanted to make visible for the ocular-centric professionals the need to sensitize themselves, learning what it means not to see or not to see well, hence stressing the need to involve the sensible expertise of blind and partially sighted people from the onset. But beyond their intervention that day, the training experiment struck me as equally, if not more, relevant. At the time, I had teaching duties at the Technical University of Munich's Department of Architecture and couldn't but remain puzzled by the difference between my students and those working at the BBSB. After months of work at the BBSB, the accessible assistants in training had a very good understanding of what learning not to see meant, rather than as a creative and expert geniuses. They conceived their roles as facilitators, never trying to speak in the name of others. As an anthropologist, teaching architecture students offered a unique opportunity to experiment with pedagogic modes, where rather than attempting my students to become proto-anthropologists, reading and commenting critically on architectural practice, I could invite them to reflect anthropologically on their own practice. Learning to pay attention to and value the variety of knowledges and skills already present in design situations. For this, I thought there was nothing better than searching them to reflect on more collaborative, participatory, and democratic design approaches, such as the one I had witnessed at the BBSB, and whether this could make, whether I could make this matter in their own practice. However, this was not an easy nor a straightforward task. Before becoming acquainted with this experience, I had naively started offering regular seminars where anthropological work on architecture and infrastructures, but also insights from participatory and collaborative design practitioners in STS works, for instance, were read and discussed. I had hoped this would have an impact on my students' architectural practice, but as interesting as these readings were, it quickly became abundantly clear that just reading was not a way in which students would ever be inspired to address the challenge or democratizing their own architectural practice. This had proven a mind breaker, leading to a series of collaborative teaching engagements together with fellow STS-minded urban anthropologist Ignacio Farias. Having experiences like the BBSB very present, we realized that the space of the classroom and the training of future design professionals was an interesting exploratory space in which we could show future professionals, as we said at the time, to become aware of the limits of their own expertise, to open themselves to other forms of sensing, knowing, and valuing, and ultimately, why not, to be trained differently. This led us to transition from a predicative pedagogical mode to a series of what we started calling more experiential ones, where we tried to develop architectural interventions. Pedagogic situations enacting a change from within the very practices of architecture students. Hence, we created challenging collective learning situations, a series of studio projects where our implicit grandiloquent aim was to critically put our students' mode of design in crisis. Drawing inspiration from accessibility activism, in the summer semester of 2017, I taught Design in Crisis 2, Coming to Our Senses, in whose conception I sought to treat blindness as a method. Rather than making students act as if they were blind, something that has been severely criticized by disability rights advocates, blindness was a way to produce an intervention radically challenging the ocular-centric practices and techniques of architectural design. The course was conceived as having two parts. In the first one, we were to carry out exercises to foreground the multisensory terrains we needed to navigate in order to learn not to see. After some weeks doing this training of sorts, the official assignment of the course was revealed. Students should prototype collectively and disposing of any kind of individualism, a new architectural toolkit for a blind architect. My main inspiration for this was Chris Downey, a San Francisco-based architect who, after becoming blind, started adapting his tools of the trade to keep on working. He has been now collaborating with the Bartlett School of Architecture in London. As a result, students had to explore and do research about existing devices, methods, and skills for blind, non-blind communication. Based on their research and our discussions, they started slowly prototyping a toolkit for non-visual, multisensorial design practice, called ManualCAD in their terms. My proposal was that the resulting product, rather than an object in itself, might stand for their learning process. So a full documentation of everything was enforced, generating many moments of reflexivity of the making tasks at hand. Every week, before or after showing the results from the previous one, we discussed readings from SDS or participatory design. And this was how, bit by bit, this multisensory toolkit for a non-visual architecture gradually came into existence. Rather than a solution for an almost impossible challenge, the pedagogical situation elicited an object allowing them to make good questions, or rather, to open up design as a problem, materializing the explorations needed to do so. So, when anthropologists or other social scientists are asked to have a role in design practice, and this is becoming increasingly more so, we tend to be required to remain complicit to the modernist pact of social utility and public good of technoscience. This involves a clear demarcation of ontological regions and a well-maintained division of labor. The social sciences conventionally being framed as either providing knowledge about the social, giving insight to designers about users and their predicaments, or as managing through more or less participatory methods, the ethical predicaments or the social or societal consequences of the designer's work. Or also as providers of theory for the designer's exploratory activities. But what if our role was not to represent the social or to set up more or less tokenistic participatory processes for the designers to work smoothly or to act as their theoretical shamans or guides? As I have tried to show, if anthropology would like to contribute to more democratic modes of togetherness so that diverging and plural worlds could thrive, perhaps we need to envision a future where we do not just engage through superbly well-written stories with a political or a conceptual twist, but learning to design. I would like to believe that in the pedagogic intervention I just showed lies a tentative call to start practicing anthropology as a form of careful design. One, creating situations whereby to experiment with ways for anthropology to matter in context of asymmetric knowledge politics, such as architectural practice. Sensitizing all involved to undo potentially exclusionary practices so as to carve out spaces for usually neglected bodily experiences, knowledges, and skills. Of course, I only showed a meager example, and would very much like
I would like
to
tackle the question of collaboration and the meaning of collaboration and your work. And you both explored also what Criado and Seleja have termed epistemic collaboration as a form of engaging with your interlocutors in the field and the idea of of the construction of joint anthropological problematizations. So I would like to know in which ways these collaborative settings of your projects actually have an impact on how on your anthropological work.
So how the way of doing anthropology transformed or this collaborative space transformed the project. I set out to do an anthropology of austerity medicine, so how austerity policies actually transform healthcare. And due to questions of access to the field, which were highly problematic with this political and politicized topic, it took me quite a while to get the research permissions to go into hospitals and health centers. So meanwhile, I started with this community health project I knew from former engagements. And so I actually stayed with them all the way through. And what they helped me to see and what the collaborative setting helped me to see was that austerity was not so much a question or a problem for them. So really in the typical anthropological way, also the field is something which opens up new question, and especially a field in which very different people engage with each other, like health professionals quite from upper classes and with really poor people. And so it helped me to see the much deeper and far-reaching embodied inequalities maybe of the long durée, but also helped me to to think about it differently and maybe to do something about it or the way these inequalities are addressed in institutions. So I participated in the crafting of a written guide, which was called Knitting Health, which then went out to the Madrid City Council and was distributed among health professionals. But also, it helped me actually to get into other spaces of the otherwise and see that within these austere medical institutions, many like spaces of professionals and communities exist where actually this more understanding and proximate forms of care are experimented with. And I think the health project and the collaborators with them helped me to also get and notice these other spaces, which are in many, many spaces, yeah.
In what I've presented today, maybe collaboration takes a different kind of contour or different forms. But in most of my previous work, mostly working with activist designers in Barcelona, we created together a platform, a collective that was called Entorno a la Silla, playing with the different nuances of these terms in Spanish, situating ourselves around environments, producing environments to situate ourselves around them, and you know, intervening materially to think together. In working with them is when I realized that, well, basically all I've been doing ethnographically was also part of the documentation of the project, and basically the conditions of documentation were also creating conditions so that we could be debating what we had been doing together. So in the end, I started calling all of that joint problem making, because we were making problems together, but at the same time we were creating problems through making. And making things was, in a way, allowing us to create conditions of being together and explore our differences that were many and, of course, in many cases, incommensurable. In this particular thing that I've been presenting today, I've been trying to think about what that might mean, going beyond the ethnographic register, where we go to places and live together with people, participate in their lives. With, well, creating more or less forms of being together, and I think also collaboration can happen through these forms of learning how to craft spaces of mutual exposure. Even though perhaps the forms of the epistemic here are different, it is not just in the sense that we are transforming the way in which we do ethnography through what they do, but perhaps that we could relearn how to be doing things from their own practices and find alternative ways in which we could be transforming what anthropology might mean. That was a bit more than.
You both have actually worked, and also you have also. Yeah, extensive teaching experience in interdisciplinary settings. So you mentioned it a little bit in your talk about your about teaching anthropology to architecture students, but also I know from you, Janina, that you were teaching medical students. So I would be interested in, where do you see the promises, but maybe also the pitfalls of teaching anthropology or in working, but maybe also teaching in interdisciplinary settings?
So maybe with medical students is a bit special because, they want to study medicine, they're interested in medicine, and they don't really care about either anthropology or history. So this is the biggest challenge, I would say, if you go in there and have an auditorium of 100 medical students and you should tell them in 45 minutes why they should listen to you. And so, but I think this is I think we're trained actually to do this as anthropologists because we're used to verfremden things, so other things, and I think what I try to do in these settings, and maybe it's very different with architecture students, is to try to offer them a different perspective on what they are doing in conversation with them. So this can mean, in more semi-like forms, watching a film on Médecins Sans Frontières and then read a text by Peter Radfield on the same and discuss about the power structures, about things they haven't really thought about in their intention to go to Namibia and do good there in a humanitarian project. So I think it's really the confrontation of what we have learned in anthropology and confronting them with other visions of what they're doing and just offering them, and some take them and others just don't listen, and I think that's the way it is.
Well, I think I've been explaining a lot of about this. Just one minor remark. Mm-hmm. I don't know what, I mean, when we talk about interdisciplinary relations, I have the feeling that most of the times we are thinking of relations of equality. But most of the times, these interdisciplinary settings are extremely asymmetric, and anthropology is perhaps not very well equipped to deal with people who believe that they are even, you know, more entitled to the truth than we tend ourselves to think we are. And in most of these situations, we need to undo these asymmetries in extremely brutal even ways, because if not, we're constantly going to be reduced to the professionals of the social, you know, to this outer layer, outer crust of what, you know, that first they do what matters and then we do the societal mm-hmm. consequences kind of thing. And I have the feeling that for that to be productive and interesting, perhaps we also need to engage in intradisciplinary transformations and interventions. Yeah.